All right, we record. We are now officially live. I am here joined with my buddy Sam Murphy. Now, Sam, now the reason why I got you on this podcast is because it's been a long time coming. We can definitely say that's for sure. But also, man, like out of all the people I've met, especially as people in Perth, you've got quite a history. I mean, you've had quite a pretty exceptional life leading up to this point. And I was just want to start off right off the bat, man. Like I was scrolling for Instagram just the other day, and you just did like another powerlifting competition, didn't you?
No, so I was I've been heavily involved with the new Power Pit, which is sort of a setup from the Muscle Pit gym. So the two gyms have got together, my other gym, Power Fitness, and Muscle Pit got together and created the Power Pit. And this weekend just gone, we had our first competition, and I had four of my guys compete in it, and it was epic, man. It was really good.
How did it go? How did you guys get on?
Yeah, so one of my guys took it out. It's a novice comp, but he won on formula and stuff. Strong as hell. His name's Matt, and he squatted. He's 90 kilos, and he squatted 260, benched 150, deadlift 270. He's strong
Wow,
dude.
that's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, I know you've been powerlifting for quite some time. What can you tell us about that? How did you get into it?
I started in this sort of sport and the gym. I started with rugby league. It's the reason I got into the gym, was to, create some dynamic strength and power for my footy. But then I hurt my collarbone, dislocated my AC, so I
Oh.
couldn't really take the hits or get up and down anymore. So I basically gave up footy and just spent time in the gym strengthening my shoulder. And then you get to a point where if you just go into the gym for no reason, it's like running a marathon and not knowing how long it is. There's not much to motivate you to keep doing that. So I took up judo, and I started doing judo. I did that for 4 years. I competed in the IJF Nationals and the Kodokan Nationals, and I won the Kodokan Nationals. Came fourth in the IJF, but the three people who won it were at a level miles above what I was at. But I realized doing that sport, it was a young man's game. You really had to travel the world to be successful. You had to travel the world and get the ranking. So I had a wife and two kids. I can't afford to be traveling the world trying to bloody fight people with judo. So I moved on from that, and I thought, I'm just going to put some size on. So I started doing that and thought, oh, what am I going to do with this size? I want to be big, but I want to look good as well. So that's when I started bodybuilding. I've done that for, well, 8 years, and my coach noticed I was getting pretty strong pretty quickly. And it was 2019. He said, how about we give this powerlifting stuff a go? And I went, yeah, all right. And my wife's been telling me to do it for years, but I'm like, oh no, I'm doing bodybuilding. I love it, And then so I gave it a go, and we did the novice comp, Sons of Odin, won that by a long shot with a 780 total. And then I did four bodybuilding shows straight after that. So I was actually preparing for a bodybuilding show when I did that. I've always done okay at bodybuilding. I've competed at Arnold's and stuff like that, but never at the top level. It was just my shape wasn't, my waist is probably a bit too big to be a really good bodybuilder. So I just have to get massive to sort of make my waist look small. And then at the end of November in 2019, I decided I was going to do the sanctioned powerlifting comp, which was just a push pull, the bench and deadlift comp, just to finish the year out. And we went in, we won that as well. So I was then approached by a couple of people, a mate from bodybuilding, and Henry Day from CAPA Australia. He runs Muscle Pit, and they suggested that powerlifting was probably a better direction for me than bodybuilding. So it's quite hard actually to change that mental process to, this is what I do, I'm a bodybuilder, to, okay, now I'm going to focus on this. Especially after 8 years of doing it, mentally it's pretty tough. But we moved across, and then this year, the COVID, was supposed to compete in March, but when COVID hit, like a week before the comp, and everything got shut down, so that didn't happen. So then we prepared for states, which I won. Won my 125 category and the overalls, up against some really awesome dudes too. But I spent a lot of time training out of Muscle Pit to learn from the best. You know, like, if you want to be the best, you surround yourself with the best. It's like UFC fighters. They don't go and just train in their garage. They go and get the best coaches in stand-up and groundwork, and they work with them. You know, it's the same thing. It's basically what I did. Is I went and benched with some of the best benchers. I went and squatted with some of the best squatters, and I deadlifted with the best deadlifters, and just progressively improve what I did. So that's what led me to helping these guys set up this power pit here, and it's been awesome, man.
So what makes the Muscle Pit such a successful gym then?
If you walk in there and you can just feel that energy, like, so my sister joined up with the Muscle Pit last year, and she said it's the first gym she's walked into where the women in the gym come up to you and say g'day. She said she goes to, you know, commercial gyms, and generally the other women in the gym are very recluse and keep to themselves and don't really, it's not that they're rude, they've just got no interest in meeting people at the gym. Whereas when you go to Power Pit, it's such a community driven gym that everyone wants to know everyone and help everyone out, and it's all about helping each other progress. And you can just feel the energy. Like, I remember during COVID doing squats at home, and 170 felt like hell on my back. And then when the gym finally opened, I went to Muscle Pit and put 200 on the bar and felt like nothing. And it's just that energy in that place. When you're there to work. And it's just, you know, Henry Day is pretty much the one who's made that what it is. And he's a hard man, but one of the nicest guys will give you the shirt off his own back, you know. So he's always helped me, and I'm pretty grateful for that.
Mm. So let's talk about your bodybuilding experience. Now, you said you've been bodybuilding, competing for 8 years, was it? Yeah. So let's rewind the clocks. What was it like when you first competed in bodybuilding?
I had no idea what I was doing, man. No idea. My first comp, I was soft. I thought I was about 96 kilos, and I did an ICN comp, and I was huge, man. Like, compared to everyone else, I was massive, and it was because I wasn't lean enough, you know? So I was lean, but leanest I'd ever been, but not lean enough to compete against some of those guys, because ICN is really condition driven. So I didn't know, I was learning. I had no idea what to do with my water or my food or any of that stuff. I just kept eating, you know. So I was big and relatively lean. I wouldn't say I was anywhere near what I should have been, but it was hard, man. But then I did my first comp and I realized, shit, I need someone who can help me. I got a friend who's, you know, pretty well-known coach in WA, Michelle Nazaroff, and she helped me get really lean. But I felt like getting that lean compromised a lot of muscle for me. I did probably two or three comps back to back. What I like to do is I'd like to get really lean, shredded, and then do as many comps close together as I can, and then come off and come to an off season, because it's so much, so taxing, especially on your family with your diet and stuff. People never really look at that. Like, when you're a focused athlete, everything else sort of takes a back seat. And I'm one of those people, I hyper focus, like I'm ADHD. I'm either not focused at all or I'm hyper focused. Yeah. So I've the bodybuilding was, I enjoyed how hard it was, but my wife didn't.
So I wanted to ask you, over those 8 years of bodybuilding, like, what's changed the most for you, and what's changed the most as a sport of bodybuilding?
For me, I like the big, huge look, and they're getting better at keeping the waist in and stuff on those big guys, which is really good. That's a positive change, because I went from, like, a really classic look to this mass monster back to sort of an in-between, which I really like. But the biggest change is the growth in bikini and men's physique. So men's bikini, basically the board short ones, and the introduction of classic physique. So bringing back that classic, but like you'll go to a bodybuilding competition, there'll be one super heavyweight, a couple of lighter weight guys in the bodybuilding side, and then you'll have 50 bikini girls, 30 physique guys. Like, it's just huge in that area. So that's where bodybuilding's, I guess, making their comeback now, is with that sort of stuff.
Now, so
it's changed a lot.
Yeah. Like, with the bikini and with the physique, what do you believe, what is it about it that makes it so popular? Do you believe it's because, potentially because it's not as, let's say, as challenging as, if they say, you know, for men's bodybuilding? Or do you just believe it's more appealing to the public?
It's more attainable.
Mm-hmm.
So people see it as a more attainable physique. So getting lean, and having a small amount of muscle but being really tight is a lot easier to achieve than putting on a lot of mass and being really tight and lean. So the challenges are different, but it's like you can grab anyone from the gym, get them lean and put them on stage in a physique competition. And the girls in bikini, I think a lot of girls, if you've got a pretty face, you're going to do well in bikini, but it's not so much the case. A lot of the girls that are really good have trained for years, and underneath that, you know, that's soft. So that their look is a lot softer. It's not, they don't want to see six pack abs and stuff like that in bikini. They want to see tight body with a softer look. But to do that, you need a lot of muscle underneath there. So some of those girls work really hard just for bikini, but their look looks attainable. Looks like any woman could attain that. And if you've got good legs and stuff, then you're probably going to do all right in that area.
Mm-hmm. And you're also a coach for these girls that compete in bikini competitions. Is that true?
I've done, yeah, a couple of bikini girls and some physique or, sorry, figure girls. Mm-hmm. I've coached a couple. And, yeah, women particularly, it's a different kettle of fish altogether when you're training with women to men with food and stuff like that. Like, so when they're in the first half of, like, say their 4 week cycle, and you've got the first 2 weeks where it starts all again, their energy consumption goes way up. So they actually, to stay on a diet when your energy consumption go, let's say you add another 500 calories a day to what you need, and but you're still on a deficit, it's really hard to maintain. So it's being able to understand that and, you know, move the foods around. Women tend to need a lot more fats in their diet and a lot more vegetables and stuff to keep everything in balance. So you really, it's hard work, but if you get the right athlete, it's pretty rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And what's the difference between, what's the difference in terms of preparation between a figure athlete and a bikini athlete? How do they differ?
Basically how lean you want to get them.
Okay.
So a figure, it's a lot more muscular look. It's a lot leaner. So you want them a lot tighter. You want, it's all about balance with figure as well. Those big cap shoulders to make the waist look small, and nice legs, but they need to be lean. Everything needs to be really lean. With the bikini, you want that same sort of look, but a lot softer looking. So you don't need really big cap shoulders, just nice round shoulders. You don't need a huge muscular back. You just need a relatively lean back. Like the look's just different. So you have to focus training wise on one's not, you don't have to work them as hard to get them as lean. And the other one, you got to work a lot harder. What I try and do is work them very similar. But as we get closer, one's doing the figure's doing a lot more cardio work and tighter dieting and stuff like that. Yeah.
Oh, nice. And I was just wanting to bring up one time when we first met, you used to tell me your history that you used to be in the Navy and you used to work as a chef in the Navy and all that. I don't think I ever asked you, what made you sign up to the Navy, and then how old were you when you enlisted?
So I was 17 when I joined. 17 and a half. Yeah.
Wow, that's really young. So what was so appealing about it?
I always wanted to be a chef, and I left school year 10 and started going to TAFE and working in pubs and restaurants and stuff like that, trying to nail down an apprenticeship, and it just wasn't happening. I was doing working a lot, but never really getting the tick, here's your apprenticeship. So a lot of my family has been in the Navy, my grandfather, my cousins, my sister joined after me. So a lot of our family have been in the Navy. So I had a look at it and was like, oh, you know what, I can get my trade out of it. So that's the whole reason I joined, was to get my trade. I did my 4 years and spent most of my time at sea and then got out.
And then what happened once you got out?
I got moved over here because my brother got me some work on the mines.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really enjoy it. It was working on the mills and stuff, and it was pretty boring, to be honest. Like, it was a job where you hose concrete all day or fucking clean up shit. Like, it was a very boring, mind-numbing job. And I got ADHD, so I got shit to do, man. You know, like, I can't be just standing around hosing fucking concrete all day. So, and especially when I was younger. So I was like, you know what, I'm out of here. And I went and I just worked with a construction mob doing some concreting and steel fixing. I worked in a restaurant and tried to make that work, and then they tried to rip me off. So
how did they do that?
I had my interview with the guy. He said, how much do you get paid? And I'm like, well, over East, they pay probably $35 an hour for a chef to run the restaurant. Mm-hmm. He goes, oh, you probably won't get that over here. And this was many years ago. And I was like, yeah, no worries, as long as we're close. Like, he said, no worries, we'll talk about it more. He said, come in on the weekend and, you know, do it and we'll see how you go. So I went in Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and ran the pub, ran the restaurant. And then on, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, I got my pay slip, and I read it, and it was like $32 an hour on Sunday. And I was like, that's fucking $16 an hour because it's double time Sunday. So I called him up and was like, hey, mate, I'm just having a look at my pay slip here. And he's like, yeah, well, fuck it, I said we'd talk about it. And I went, well, it's fucking $16 an hour, mate. And he goes, yeah, I know that. Well, will you call me up having a go at me? I said, hang on, I wasn't having a go at you, but the way you're acting makes me feel like you fucking deliberately ripped me off. I said, are you at the pub? He went, yeah. I said, wait there, I'm fucking coming down. And when I got there, he was gone. But yeah, that was the end of my... I just said, you stick it up your ass, mate, and I went back to concrete.
Very nice. So I actually wanted to ask, like, about being ADHD, like, when were you first diagnosed, and how do you cope with it and all that?
Well, I only got diagnosed a few years ago, and it was when my son got diagnosed. I looked at what they diagnosed him with, and I was like, fuck, that's me. Like, that was me. I'll be having a conversation with someone and we'll be in the middle of a conversation and you'll say something that triggers a thought, and I'll drift off and start thinking about what else is going on, but you're still talking. Mm-hmm. So then I've got, oh shit, I've got to come back to the conversation and pick up where I left off to try and figure out what you're doing. So it come up with a lot of no worries. Meetings are the worst. Like doing business meetings like fucking kill me, because trying to concentrate for that long was just hectic. But I like I said, like I'm one of those people, I'm either super hyper focused or not at all. So generally when I take things on, I give it everything, and I grow pretty well. So the psychologist said to me when he diagnosed me, he said, you've done really well to get where you are with this issue. But the way I worked, figured it out during my life, is cooking actually really helped, because you don't want to put the potatoes on at the same time as steak, because potatoes take 40 minutes, steak takes 5-10 minutes. So you've got to go, okay, well, you've got to schedule things in. So learning how to do that, and that's how my brain works now, just stacks things and schedules things. And I'm not a hyperactive ADHD. I sometimes struggle to focus. And so really affects me in conversations and meetings and stuff like that, which is pretty important for my work.
Mm-hmm. And now your son, Kobe?
Yep.
So your son Kobe has ADHD. So one thing I wanted to actually ask you, what advice can you give to parents whose children also have ADHD?
Yeah, so Kobe's got ADHD, and he's got autism. He's on the spectrum, like Asperger's.
Mm-hmm.
So socially, he struggles a bit. Only advice I can really give is to make them sociable, take them to things where there's other kids, take them out. So the COVID really affected him. So he was, because he was at home by ourselves with just us, he wasn't used to crowds and that. Mm-hmm. So when we took him to the shops, he would rock, like he gets this rock on, which is just like a stimulation thing to take his mind off everything that's going on. And he really struggled, but it only really stood out when he spent time away from people. So once he's back with people and gets used to it again, he's good. He doesn't have any dramas. So it's more about getting them into things. Like Kobe does Olympic lifting, has done for a while. He's going to move into powerlifting, but he used to be really bad with loud noises. But I don't know whether you've been to an Olympic lifting gym, they do a snatch or a clean and jerk, and then they just drop it from height, right beside you. And I still jump when it happens, but he's got so used to it now, it's just normal. When he's in the gym, he doesn't even notice it. So it's helped him with the social side of things, because like you can't put him in a team sport because he doesn't understand his role. But you put him in an individual sport like lifting, he's actually got a team around him, but he's not responsible for any of them. He's responsible for his own outcome. So it gives him the ability to, chase his own goals, but also be supported by a team. So I think it's really helped him, that sort of environment.
Mm. And how old is Kobe again?
No, he's 11, turns 12 in February.
Oh, so he turns 12 in February. And how long did you say he's been Olympic lifting for?
3 or 4 years.
3 or 4 years. So he started quite young.
Yeah. So originally it was got nothing to do with the weight he was lifting. It was all technique stuff, mm-hmm. because he plays computer games, loves computer games. He's always seated. So he gets tight hip flexors. He had no mobility. He couldn't get down to the bar properly without, his heels lifting and stuff like that. So we just focused on for him to be able to do like overhead squats with a broom handle and, no weight. And his coach, who's Bob Pavone, he had these 8-kilo Olympic barbells, so they weren't heavy, and he just grew from there. So it was just very slow progression. We weren't pushing him, weren't rushing him, but he's strong. He's a really strong kid.
Mm.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a lot of stigma, and there's a lot of debate around children and lifting weights at a very early age today. Now, obviously, you've shown that in your with your son, it actually has a high benefit, especially with someone who's dealing with autism and dealing with ADHD. So let's talk about children lifting, and let's talk about why you would recommend it to other parents, say the least.
Yeah, so I've got arthritis in both my hips, okay. And I'm 37. So okay. Both my hips are stuffed. The reason my hips are stuffed is because I've got what they call a CAM lesion. So the head of my bone, the joint goes into my hip socket, is not a ball. It actually runs straight into the bones. So there's no actual ball bit. So the specialist believes that's caused from I started playing footy when I was five. So I played Aussie rules when I was a young kid. I played state mm-hmm. Aussie rules and stuff. He reckons that gated movement didn't give my hip joint the time to develop properly. So it developed in that shape that it's in. And then from playing years of football and stuff, as that comes, it doesn't roll properly in the socket. So it's actually been rubbing in my hip socket, which has caused cartilage damage on my knuckle and stuff like that. So actually doing gated movements, running, jumping, that sort of stuff, has actually caused more harm than would have been if I was just doing stationary movements, which is what Olympic lifting is. So there's less chance of him being injured, having head injuries, breaking bones. Like, I don't know how many bones I've broken playing football. Like I've had cracked ribs, broken noses, all sorts of stuff playing rugby league. But it's his ability to be stationary, do the movements, grow, get stronger, so his bone density is better. And I would say, like, if your kid's doing AFL, rugby league, any of those sports as well, get them lifting to strengthen their tendons, because basically, like, they're recruiting kids for Aussie rules at 16, 17, and they're still kids. But as soon as they play an AFL game, they're playing against men. So their tendon strength, like muscle strength is easy to build, but their tendon strength when they're young is not going to be as good as a grown man who's going up against them. So you want to help build that, and you do that through moving weights. Mm-hmm. Henry Day is really good at doing that. He's got a couple of really hopeful AFL players, potential AFL players coming out of his gym at the moment. It's really focused on building that tendon strength, because that's what's going to allow those kids to have a long career, not a short one.
Mm-hmm. And what is some advice you can give to those young athletes trying to build that tendon strength?
Get a good coach. Find the right coach. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Find someone who understands what you're trying to achieve. Jeremy Hogg, Henry Day, any of those guys that really understand strength and performance. They understand like fartlek type training and building up. Because now we've got the new women's AFL, women have completely different issues when it comes to injuries and injury prevention and stuff. So having coaches that understand, you know, a lot of women have a lot of hamstring issues.
Why is that?
And I'm not sure. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but it just seems to be a common issue and common injury with women are playing Aussie rules. I know when I'm training some women in the gym doing deadlifts and squats and stuff, a lot of them have issue turning their glutes on.
Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of work doing a lot of banded work trying to get that. So I think their back chain just doesn't fire as quickly as the men's back chain does. And when you're sprinting and doing those sort of things, it takes a lot of work to make sure that fires properly for you. Because the last thing you want is to be running. And if your hamstrings aren't doing the work they need to do, your lower back does. You know, so it all works in conjunction. So everything needs to be as strong as supporters of each other. So having a coach that understands how to get you to that point so that you've got a long career in the sport, not just, you know, hey, I made the AFL and I played one season and I'm fucked. Mm-hmm. You want to be there. Yeah.
Fair enough. So let's revert back to powerlifting, because now we've got quite a few powerlifting questions that I just wanted to cover with you. Now, I remember some time ago when I was starting as a trainer, I was, you know, putting things up on social media. One thing I put up was a video of one of my clients actually deadlifting. And then I remember that you sent me a message later that day saying, "I'll tell your client to stack his feet under his shoulders." And yeah. I wanted to ask you right now on film, why is it that you should be stacking your feet under your shoulders when you're deadlifting?
So it's not for everyone. It depends on your deadlift. Like if you're doing a sumo deadlift, obviously you're not going to be doing that. But that all comes down to your hip sockets. Do you have big hip sockets? Do you have small hip sockets? What are you actually capable of expanding to? So if you're doing a conventional deadlift, it's not like a squat. You want knee flexion. You want the ability to turn your hamstrings on. If your legs are out or your feet are out like this, your glutes are on at the bottom. But if you've ever tried to do a leg curl with your toes out, you can't turn your hamstring on. It's almost impossible to turn that hamstring on. So when your feet, toes are a lot straighter, some people can't, you know, like if you've got a club foot or whatever, that's fine. It's going to be uncomfortable. You can't. So you've got a slight turnout, but you don't want your feet turned ducked right out like an Olympic powerlifter, Olympic weightlifter, sorry. You want a good stance stacked underneath you. What that's going to do is it's going to allow you to pull into it more and drive with all your legs. So basically, I look at the deadlift as like a leg press where you're holding the bar. That's how I look at it. So, and with a leg press, when you go really wide, it seems easy, but it's easy because your range of movement is nil. Whereas if you bring your feet in to where under your shoulders, where your leg stance is, you can bring your feet down to what would be a deadlift position and drive out. And that position is strong, really strong. So we're trying to create a strong position that allows you, your toes aren't out, it's not loading up your lower back from the bottom. You know, if you can turn your glutes on when you get to the top and to lock out, you don't need your toes out wide out at the bottom unless you can't. Like a lot of women, I'll get them to toe out just a little bit, but if they've got back problems, I'll straighten their feet right up because I don't want their back turned on at the hardest part of the movement, ripping it off the floor. Mm-hmm. So being stacked gives you the ability to draw way more muscle fibers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's very nice. Now, also speaking of in powerlifting, especially in deadlifting, there's a lot of debate these days about which style of deadlifting is better between the sumo and the conventional. What's your take on it?
I think it's just a leverage. Like if you've got the ability for your hip mobility to go sumo and you're a smaller guy, you're going to get way more leverage out of a sumo than you would out of a conventional. But if you're strong and can recruit all those muscles from your legs, your back can remain tight and you can hold that bar, then a conventional deadlift is going to benefit you. The world record for raw deadlift without straps is 460 by Benedict Magnussen. And he's a super heavyweight guy. So he's probably around 180 kilos. But the guy who's coming in second is Yuri Belkin, who's about 103 kilos or 106 kilos. And he done 445 in a sumo position. So, yeah, Benedict did it conventionally and Yuri Belkin did it in a sumo position. But if you watch him lift, it's technically perfect. It's all leverage-based. So it's about making the bar path as short as possible so that at lockout, so which is shoulders, knees, feet all lined up, he's able to recruit as much as he can for that lift. So it's almost doing, for him, it's almost like he's doing a rack pull, you know, like it's, but for me, I'm 6'1.5", nearly 6'2". If I was to try and get in a sumo position, my feet would be under the plates. Mm-hmm. So like to get my feet wide enough. A lot of people think they're doing sumo, but a lot of the time it's just wide stance conventional deadlifting. Okay. because sumo, the whole mechanism for sumo is completely different. I'm still learning the sumo technique itself. Like, there's much better guys than me to teach people how to do sumo deadlifting. Because the technique itself is so different to a conventional. But I'm a conventional guy. I love it. But if I can do sumo up to about 200, and then I can't break the floor with it because my hips just won't allow me to. So I just can't get my position right. Mm-hmm. So because I can't get my feet in the right position. Yeah. And it scares the shit out of me, sumo. Because if you're lifting the bar and your feet slip and you drop the bar, you're dropping the bar on your feet.
Yeah.
You know, and like, I got no interest in dropping hundreds of kilos on my feet.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't think anyone really does. So moving on to the bench press, and what are some tips you can give to someone to help improve their bench press?
Get tight.
Get tight.
That's for every lift. Get tight. Take that breath, bury it in your belly, get tight. Like, if you come and kick me while I'm on the bench, I'm not going to move. Mm-hmm. So it's finding good base, getting your body tight. And when you're driving, like when you're lowering the bar, you're not doing it to build your chest. That's not the goal. So bringing it down to touch your chest is not the ultimate goal. Like, if you have a broom handle and just bring it in like that, most people aren't going to be able to touch their chest. The only way to touch your chest would be to either drop your elbows or lift your elbows. Mm-hmm. When you lift your elbows, it's all in your shoulders now. So you're bench pressing off your chest through your front delts. That's why a lot of people go, oh, I've got a sore shoulder this week from benching.
Yeah.
You shouldn't, because if you get tight, turn your lats on and just let the bar fall, it's not even going to touch your chest most of the time. It's going to sit just below your chest, and that gives you a good position to turn your lats on, to push your triceps down and drive from there and take your shoulders out of the equation. Because if you're loading up your shoulders and you're doing heavy bench all the time, you're going to get pissy shoulders. It's just what's going to happen. So my advice is get tight and try and take your shoulders out of the lift, especially if you're lifting for strength. If you're lifting for building your chest, don't worry about it, because you don't actually have to touch your chest to build your chest. So if you're focusing on just on that contraction on the chest, it doesn't matter. But if you're loading that bar up to do that, and you've got, 160 kilos on there, and you're just benching over your chest, you're going to end up with sore shoulders. Mm-hmm. It's learning how to set up and take the shoulders out of it.
So you always recommend like bringing the shoulders in?
Yeah, so it's more about turning your lats on. Like, if you've got the bar and you pretend you're bending the bar and your shoulders down towards your bum, it's going to turn your lats on. So your lats are going to light up. So what that means is when the bar comes down, your elbows are going to be in slightly. You just let the bar fall where it lands, drive out and over your head. So that bar path is actually, it's like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not like a lot of people try and bench like this.
Yeah, it's not a straight line, it's a curve. Yeah.
Yes, because if you're lifting a heavy weight straight up like that, or you drag it up a ramp, the ramp's going to be easier because mm-hmm. you're taking that degree of out of it. So it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's, in terms of like specialty bars when it comes to benching, how often do you switch up your training?
I don't tend to change my bar much with mm-hmm. bench, but I will do work from the bottom portion, work from the top portion, sometimes just lockouts where I've got, let's say my top bench is 200, I'll put 220 on there and just take it from at the top part of my position and lock it out
mm-hmm.
and get stronger there. And then I'll work at the bottom part by doing maybe floor presses or block presses, or so I'll just do variations. It's like when you do Olympic lifting and you do a snatch, you do snatch pulls to knees, you do snatch pulls where you go up onto your toes, and then you do hang snatches, like you do overhead squats. All those things are part of that one lift, but they're variations to build you in different sections. So when you have weak points in a bench, so your weak point might be getting it off the chest. So you're going to practice that part of the movement. So you want it to be, so that's when people put more load on the bar with bands to help get it off the chest, so they build strength off the chest. Or yeah, it's about breaking that lift down and fixing the parts that you're lacking in. Dips are really good. Body weight dips are really good for developing your chest, your bench.
Why is that? Why would you recommend dips?
Just the mechanism. So obviously when you're lifting for power, you're turning those lats on. So when you're on the dip machine, you've got to get tight so that you can actually control your body weight up and down. And you're using a lot of tricep work. And if you can do upright dips, you're actually engaging your chest as well. Mm-hmm. So you're not actually doing full bends with your elbow. You're actually just engaging your chest. And you can load them up. And eventually when you get really strong at them, you've got weight hanging off you and you're doing sets of 10 and 15. I always like to do a lot of volume in my accessory stuff, but with my heavy stuff, not as much, unless it's off season like I am at the moment. And I try and do lower percentages, higher repetition, and just try and really work those groups and hit that groove, because it takes time.
And for you, next on moving on to the squat and all that. Now, sorry, next up, moving on to the squat. Like, what are some ways in which we can bring up the squat? Now, there's a lot of, depending on anatomy, the squat technique is going to be different. How do you know if you find the right technique for you based on your anatomy?
So I love low bar. I think it puts you in a much stronger position. You're able to turn your lats on, your back on, and make you really tight. A lot of people like high bar squat, like Olympic lifters always high bar squat. But I think the best way to do it is Dr. Andrew Locke has a video on his website, and it talks about finding your squat stance. It's the squat hack, he calls it. But basically you sit in a seat, take your knees out where your knees and feet are directly over each other. Like if your feet are out and your knees are here, then you want those knees, this feet directly under your knees. So you bring them out until you're comfortable and you get tight. So you feel your glutes and everything are turned on. And then you just bring your feet in until your glutes come off, but you can drive your knees out to turn them on if you want to. And that is your feet stance position. And when it comes to a squat, it'll just depend on your torso length and your femur length, like on what your position is going to look like at the bottom. I prefer to avoid knee flexion as much as possible. So sitting back more in the squat, just to take the load off your knees. And what it also does is if that's your knee joint, when you get more knee flexion, your knee, your patella gets closer to the floor, which means if you want to hit depth in a powerlifting squat, you've got to get lower. Mm-hmm. So higher knee flexion means that's depth. Lower knee flexion means that's depth. So you can actually save people's back by removing knee flexion, because you know how a lot of people, they go too deep and they get that butt wink because they've got no mobility in their hips and stuff like that. Getting all that right makes a huge difference to, okay, this is where I am. And as your body changes, so as you get bigger or smaller, your technique changes. You know, like if you're big and got a massive guts on you, like you want to be a bit wider so you can drop that in the hole. And especially on deadlift, it's really hard to stack yourself if you've got a big belly hanging out forward. That's why you see a lot of those really big guys. One, they've got massive legs, but two, they've got a big gut, so they've got to sit in between their legs as well. So your position will change depending on your body makeup, like size versus what it was. So my squat and almost everyone's squat is continually evolving. And it's the same with every technique. It continually evolves. And my guys, I get them in the gym and we have a look at them every month or two and just reassess the way they're doing it to make sure that, you know, is there any room for improvement? Can we make this better? And that's always the goal.
Interesting. So I feel like that just about wraps up most of it, most of the interview. I just want to say real quick, man, is there anything you would like to give a shout out to or anything you would like to announce to the viewers?
We've got, so obviously the Power Pit has started up here in Rockingham. And it's something I've been very integral in helping them set up. The shipping has killed us. So we've been waiting on our last couple of bits of equipment so we can do our pre-sale, and we'll open hopefully by the end of next week. And we've already hosted one event there. We did that this weekend and it was killer. We've got another one on the 21st of March as a powerlifting comp. And that'll be our first sanction comp down here. Mm-hmm. And the CAPO have got another comp, deadlift only, on the 20th of February, which will be good. I'll be doing a bit of reffing at that one. Mm-hmm. And obviously, like, we've got the team down here all with the Monster Fit clothes that I've got going on. Sort of the goal with them is to help me, the any money I make off them helps me towards getting to the big comps like Pro Raw and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So, and I've got a couple of sponsors. Big Rigs is one of my sponsors down in Frio. And I tell you now, if you like burgers or chicken wings, it's the place to go, man. Like, it's, yeah, it's fucking awesome. Yeah.
Big Rigs.
Yeah. And obviously the massage lady that runs out of Power Pit and Power Fitness, much needed body therapy, which is Fiona. She's a sponsor as well. She helps me keep my body in check and stuff. And that's one thing I'll recommend to people, is that if you're competing in a sport, keep your body in check. Get your body checked. So when I'm prepping for a comp, I will do chiro massage every week going into the comp. It's just the difference it makes in your mobility, your ability to do what you need to do and recover is huge. So yeah, and this year we've got the goals will be states, which is in May, mm-hmm. nationals in August. They're all over here. They're all the CAPO ones, and so our goal is to go to states and set our openers for nationals, and then go to nationals and put up some new big numbers.
Awesome. Thanks again for your time, man. Really appreciate it, and all the best.